Hello and welcome back to another round of Floor Starers Anonymous with me, Emmett Lewis, and my glorious origami folding co-host, Mikael Christiansen. How are things going, Mikael?
I just snorted this entire super glue.
Nice.
So because of that, it's going great. Now, what do I usually say? Or what's he say in Chernobyl? 3.6 Röntgens, not great, not terrible.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, pretty decent. At home for a while, which is great. I'm teaching like a course at the circus school here, previously known as DOC, now known as SKH.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like a teacher for that. It's like a short one with very few students, but it's kind of nice artistic development.
Yeah.
Hand-balancing stuff.
Yeah, I was talking to Severin de Malengro, who was coaching with you, and she had nothing but high praise to sing for your artistic development stuff.
It was really cool with her. Yeah. That was before Christmas, and she it was just me and her in those classes because she's the only one, or like there are many people doing the course, but they're all kind of specialized within different disciplines, and then they hired me to deal with like the hand balancing part of stuff, and then we developed some things, which was pretty cool.
Not great, not terrible. Still kind of recovering from this shit that's really limiting my training. As in, I can't do anything really. But I'm kind of pushing back. I'll start pushing a bit harder this week, and hopefully something doesn't break again. I'm gonna go for those interested in my journey. I'm gonna go and do a phase of like bodybuilding training because I think that's basically the last thing I haven't tried, and just hopefully that does it for a few weeks and see if that does it. If not, I think I'll just commit seppuku live on the cast. We'll live stream that, and I'll follow through. No, Emma, and you know, no one's gonna say no, Emma, don't do it. Everyone's gonna be like, yeah, do it, cut harder, cut deeper.
Finally.
Go
get him.
Yeah. So that's about it. We got the monasterium is coming on. Baby's doing good. Beside all that stuff, everything's pretty good. Can't complain. I'm very happy, I have to say, that the darkness is basically over. It was dark at about 4:30 at the start of January, which was fucking a pain in the balls. And now it's still a bit light here at about 6:20 at the moment, which is fucking, you don't understand, like, I suppose you probably do, but yeah, you just don't understand.
I understand very well.
Yeah, I know you understand the darkness. It's still dark in Sweden. Even when it's shining, it's dark. But that just spring sprunging has been absolutely fantastic up in the monasterium, and just being able to walk the dog when it's not in the dark is amazing. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, like today was the first day here where like I was looking out the window, I was like, hey, this feels springy. I mean, it's Stockholm, so things are not like really cold here compared to where I grew up and stuff, and which is also further north and darker. And if you compare that to like actual north where my mom is from, okay, then we're talking. But
8 meters still, of snow at -40.
Yeah, and just the fact that it's dark the entire half year, that's rough up there.
Yeah.
But like that feeling of like, hey, like it doesn't last forever because this period right now is it's the one that's like the most piece of garbage because like it's mid-February and it's been long, but it's not over. Like,
yeah.
So it's the period I hate the most. But when you get those kind of glimpses of like, it's not going to last forever this winter either. Pretty sick. Like sun actually exists. That's always kind of it does significantly lift the mood. So that's pretty great. I can really relate to what you're saying there.
We even had kind of sun, I don't want to call it sun, but we had something shining in the sky yesterday. It was nice. We were just, you know, if you're listening to this in the future, blah, it doesn't matter. But yeah, it was just nice, had all the doors in the house, airing the house out for the first time, which was nice seeing in a while. So that was all good. Anyway, let's just get on to the cast because I'm actually kind of excited about this one.
Yes.
So it needs a bit of a preamble before we do the introduction and then this. So this is probably the first cast where me and Mikael have actually sat down and done some research. I don't think I think maybe the anatomy cast was the only one we've done a little bit of research. For this one, we actually read a text. We read it, we went through it, and we're going to comment on this text. And, you know, it's you know, normally we just, as you know, if you've listened to this many episodes in the season, you know, we just kind of decide a topic on a whim
and wing it.
And I think it works. But this one we said, no, we're going to do this justice. We're actually going to read this shit. So this...
And we have read it before. That is important.
Yeah, read it many times actually, but Mikhail, I think you got it recently or found it again, and you said, "Hold on, we need to read this because it basically has everything we say in it said slightly differently in your old speak, but it's there." And I think it kind of leads on to nicely what we're saying, talking about documenting snapshots in time and training practices. So this week we are going to review The True Art and Science of Hand Balancing by Professor Paul Anetti and Robert L. Jones.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm very excited. It was very cool to read this book again with kind of newer eyes. It was always good. So
yeah.
I recommend, if you listen to this cast, if you've gotten this far into this cast, I recommend you own a copy of this book and you can buy it. It is now published by a guy called Logan Christopher. He resurrected it sometime on his website, Lost Art of Hand Balancing. And you can find it in paperback on Amazon, about $40. So, yeah, I think this should be in your library. If you're into handstanding, this is good. It's definitely a text you need. And, yeah.
It's, yeah, like, I find it, like, it's really cool to get back to this now because when I started hand balancing 2008, when I kind of got into it and there was very little resources online, like I've talked about before, like the place that I sat and kind of discussed at least a little bit of acrobatic stuff with people, that was on trickstutorials.com by Juji Bufu, who probably many know for his bodybuilding and crazy shenanigans, but he ran like the best tricking and like acrobatic forum on the internet, possibly the best forum I've ever been to on the internet at any point in time. Yeah, that place was fucking sick. But during that time, there was no resources, and I was trying to Google hand balancing and stuff, and then I came across this site called the Lost Art of Hand Balancing, and I was very new, very excited, didn't know much, didn't know any circus people, and I just saw that there was this book by a guy named Professor Paulinetti, who was apparently like the best hand balancer who had ever lived, and the book was from, I think the first published version is from 1931, by Professor Paulinetti, or P.H. Paulinetti is what he's described as. I'm not actually sure what those initials stand for.
Yeah.
I can't at least remember if there is even a reference to it in the books. Yeah. But he was a man living in the States. I think he was Italian-American, who wrote the book. And of course, then he had a student later on, a guy named Bob Jones, who then republished a book, I think, in the 40s sometime.
Yeah, 1945.
And at that point, there was like that version of the book had a lot of pictures, while the first version only has a bunch of, it only has drawings. I was just really excited to find this. So I ordered the book from The Lost Art of Hand Balancing, which arguably was a bit of like a tacky kind of site, which is like, oh, the old secrets revealed and all that kind of stuff. And then I get the book, and I mean, it's old school, right? I mean, like, because on the website, it said that this is like the greatest training tools for hand balancing ever devised. And then you get it, and like, it's the old school banana back sort of style of learning. It's a very different kind of approach. Like, arch your back as much as you can. That is how they learned it. And like, I quickly understood that it wasn't much of kind of like a learning manual per se. But it's an incredibly interesting lens into a different era, different time, different technique and way of thinking about it, both performance-wise, circus-wise, and all of this stuff. And maybe the best part is, and you can see that immediately when you see the cover of the book, these guys knew what they were doing. Like, Paulinetti was known for being the first man to ever do the one-arm planche, and he did a solid ass one arm planche, and the things he described that he could do in the book, like it's all of the things.
Yeah.
There aren't any things that man couldn't do on his hands.
Yeah, exactly. This is the kind of thing. He could do all the stuff. They had a different style. They maybe didn't have the same vocabulary of body geometry we have. But he could do it. He could probably learn it. If he showed him Figa, he could probably learn it. The other thing that was kind of interesting is strength-wise. There's one bit in it where they're talking about a bit of a strength competition between him and some Italian. They're doing one-arm chins and shit like that, and he decided, fuck this, I'm going to show this guy his boss. So he does a back lever, pulls the Maltese, then pulls the planche on the rings. So, you know, this guy can do the shit, basically.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, it's just like, yeah, because they also describe a lot of the kind of the stuff. I mean, we're going to get more into this, but yeah, they do describe a lot of kind of their training around it, like the way where, like, when he talks about circus performers, he calls them gymnasts very often, because like my assumption there is that, like, kind of the circles of performers kind of like coincided much more, and like Paulinetti was also apparently from, I think it's in there something where that he had world records in like in his weight class for various lifts that they used to do. One lift that I think was a bicep curl into a shoulder press, and also like a military press that was absolutely insane relating to his body weight. And the man was like 52 kilos or something like that. He's a very small man, so he had like the optimal kind of body structure to be able to
do the one-arm planche.
Yes, and to do basically everything that you can in a one-arm or in handstand. And It's very interesting when they to kind of hear how it was also kind of like involved with weight training. It was kind of like part of fitness culture in a completely different way.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the things, if we go back to, you know, what we consider physical culture and all this stuff, there was no real definition between like, oh, I do bodybuilding and I don't do acrobatics. Like, if you look at what these people trained back in the day, they done bodyweight training, they done wrestling, they lifted weights, they done acrobatics. It was just kind of the milieu. It was kind of CrossFit of its day, just with less headbands. So, yeah, let's just get into it. So I have the book open here beside me. And
me too.
One of the very first things I want to comment on is, as you scroll down, so we skip the introduction by Logan Paul and just go straight to chapter one. But before chapter one, there is a lithograph of Paulinetti, and these kind of posters were really was how people, you know, would go up, like someone's coming to town, there's a vaudeville show, there's this show, there's that show, there's this person performing this, and they would have kind of like, because obviously we didn't have video, but they'd have pictures of the feats they would do in the show that you'd be able to see. And I think it's important to kind of recognize this, because you would see this in all circus arts, you'd see it for singing, you'd see it for strongmen shows, you know. It's kind of like, this is the man. And in the middle of it's got like, you know, the original conception of the most scientific and refined speciality entertainment.
Ever produced.
One hand balance in a perfect position on each hand. Original. You know, he's doing like handstands on contraptions, which was a thing. Going up and down stairs, headstands, perfect horizontal planche. You know, revolving on canes, waving flags on headstands, these kind of things. These are like, you know, I'm the boss. I'm showing you how it's done. And I think these kind of lithographs give us, they're one of the things I've studied a lot, just to see, you know, what was being presented in the kind of vaudeville show hall era of circus and other stuff. And it's very like, it is, if you can track down, you can, there's a couple of groups on Facebook, you can find them, and you can find, you know, these kind of, it's just interesting just what's being shown, you know. Other stuff, like even talking about the costumes of attractive, you know, people. Oh, where's the trapezius bra? The trapezius bra was like a curtain that would go when you'd turn upside down on your trapeze, it would flash your tits, and it was always a bit, you know, sexualized even then, these days, or kind of even sold as that way. But it is kind of, you know, interesting. It's like, oh, the only person alive who can do this. A lot of the time, they weren't the only person alive who could do it, but you don't want to say, like, one of the six guys alive who could do this one thing, the other guy will be here next month.
It's very fascinating. Like, I'm sitting and looking at this now, and just to like give a little bit of a description of it, because it's kind of, it's like, yeah, like a lithograph. It's like very, it looks like a drawing, and like you see like Paulinetti in the middle, like with a mustache and standing, looking very honorable in like this, like a suit on one side, on the other side, he's he's standing in some sort of like tight bodysuit in white with his hands behind his back.
That's another thing what they're kind of hinting at is that this guy strips off on stage. A lot, not all the time, but a lot of the time is like he'll come out in a suit and he's going to take off his clothes for you as he does these feats. As they get harder, he takes off more clothes.
Normal one,
And then, you know.
Yeah, and you even see it down here on the poster that like you, because it says undressing while balancing on the head original, and then like, you see clothes lying on the ground underneath, like the staircase that he's kind of on top of.
There was like this kind of at this era, like, you know, sexy bodies doing things was, you know, it was kind of like, this is Victorian era, and, you know, things are a bit, you know, not, you're not meant to be sexy, but you're just doing your feats, but then it is. And like, you know, this is the early thing of like a lot of, you know, bodybuilding.
I'm communicating it.
Yeah. It's how to say like, oh, you know, it's shows for the hoi polloi, sixpence, or like in some of these places you used to be able to trade jam jars to get in. You used to be able to give like a certain amount of jam jars with lids would let you into the show instead of paying like sixpence or a shilling or something. Because the jam jars, literally it was just like, you know, it was, you know, what can you afford? What have you got? This kind of thing. So that's kind of, just to put a bit in its cultural context, then, you know, I kind of like that era in circus.
Yeah, and like continuing up like a little bit, what you just say with like the cultural context, like the after kind of the introduction, which talks about the, like the preparatory training that is needed for the professional performer and blah, blah, blah. It goes directly actually into, and this is something we've talked about before in relation to aesthetics. Yeah. It goes into what is called the loosening up exercises.
Yeah.
And that essentially are ballet positions. And then the pictures are of apparently, like, I assume a ballet dancer showing the first, second, third, and fourth, and fifth position, which are kind of leg placements that you, that like make up the most fundamental like ways to stand in ballet. So it's very clear that like, and I, even you see on that poster that is higher up that like it's very, there is an aesthetic and very clear aesthetic. Like this is the, like what they're presenting us here is the proper aesthetic. This is what is beautiful is what they're saying.
Yeah.
And that is really interesting because that's what we're saying too. And they also through this book tells you what is like the healthy way of doing things, and we're just saying the opposite.
Yeah.
And then Paulinetti is better than me and everyone I know on the house.
So, yeah. It is. Yeah. It is kind of interesting. The other thing, point on the loosening up exercises from, you know, the first to fifth position of ballet and turning out, it is this kind of cross fertilization of the arts. Like they're taking a snippet of one art, like the basic exercises of ballet, and then going, no, we need to train them because it gives us something that wasn't in our art or the way we're doing it, that adds to it, that enhances it. I always think that's kind of interesting because, you know, we are in this kind of period of what we consider the great cross-fertilization where like people are getting inspired and you're like, oh, my movement practice encompasses this, that, and the other and other stuff. This stuff, like this kind of movement cultures colliding and sharing kind of bits and pieces, you know, wasn't, you know, as we said, the kind of, there wasn't so much delineation for some of them, but in some of them it was very clear delineation, but they're like, oh, this stuff is cool, we're going to put it in. So that's kind of interesting. This is so going down to the very first one. So the first chapter is basically learning the hand balance, and first thing it says, unless you can do a hand balance reasonably sure, start by using a wall for protection from falling over on the back. So, you know, straight away, boom, we're into your, you know, your first spotter is the wall. It's one of these kind of, this is what I kind of like about this book. It has a certain like universal wisdom that are kind of, no matter where you are in handstands, you know, no matter what your level, no matter what you're doing, you know, you're probably going to be using the wall either a lot or a little, you know. And it's just there.
It's interesting, like, as they describe it here. And, like, I mean, there's a picture of the arched back, kind of classic old school handstand. And he says, just as the hands reach the floor, step off the floor with the left foot with a slight push and keep the head well back, the chest high. It is better at first to allow the knees to bend, allowing the feet to hang instead of trying to keep the legs straight. It's easier and reduces the chances of falling over. Try to stay as long as you can on the hands each time, acquiring endurance, allowing the feet to touch the wall lighter and lighter until you can feel a balance. The arms should be kept rigid and stretched as far as they will go. So it's like, I mean, those are like, I mean, except kind of the bending the leg thing. I mean, the description isn't that too far off. Of course, when you look at the picture of him doing an arched back handstand, it's just an arched back handstand.
Yeah.
But
like, if he posted that on the gram nowadays, people would tell him to go back to the wall and train more.
Yeah.
And stretch his shoulders. And that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of thing. Like, it's the point we've made so many things. Like, a lot of things we think are sacrosanct in hand balance are just aesthetic choices. And maybe they're for a bit of efficiency. But, you know, as we get later in this book, there's a lot of people like doing one arm handstands while juggling, spinning flags with their feet and doing other things that are like out of fashion nowadays, but really fucking hard. So,
really fucking hard. Yeah. I'd say that the people during this era it's an interesting, this is a bit of a side note from this book, and I think maybe I've mentioned it in the previous cast, that like this era and like quite far into towards, I would say, the maybe the 1980s, maybe further, if you looked at people in professional gymnastics, they would do impressive stuff, but not that insane. Like the competition level, what they would compete would be difficult things, but not that insane. While if you look at the old school circus, where it's like someone like balances a perch on top of their head with someone in a one arm on top, and they're walking on a walking globe, and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, it's absolutely unbelievable things that like no one in the circus these days can do nor would train to do. But like, it was kind of a different thing in that sense, because like gymnastics was maybe more of a kind of people's sports thing, while the circus performers, they were the ones actively trying to push these absolutely insane feats and like coming up with new ones, because, oh yeah, that's our circus family, they're doing that, but we need to come up with something new, let's teach our kids to do XYZ.
And that's, that's the kind of thing. Like, a lot of those feats would take years and years to train, but this would be like, it would be so hard that you don't end up being the only person who's put 6 or 7 years into being able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Versus kind of nowadays, where we have a, I don't want to say generic take on handstand, but we have a generic kind of repertoire of hand balance or any circus art that people can learn and then can branch out and figure out their own style based on that. But no one is going like, okay, you know, one of the most favorite circus feats was, there was this passing troupe from back in the day, club passing, and they would do freestanding head balances on soccer balls, slightly deflated soccer balls. So when you're balancing on a ball, I don't know if you ever tried this on a unicycle or on a walking globe, you have to balance the opposite direction the way you think you're falling. So if I'm falling forward, I need to do the correction. So if it's a handstand, if I'm falling towards my back, I need to do a heel pull correction and vice versa to balance it. So they're doing free headstands while juggling and passing 7 clubs between the guys.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's just kind of like, you know, learning to do a headstand, learning to do a headstand and juggle, pretty hard. Not difficult. Learning to pass while in a headstand, pretty fucking hard. Learning to balance with all your corrections done in the opposite direction in a headstand while passing clubs, not just any clubs, 7 clubs, so you're on an offbeat rhythm. It's just like, oh, we're the guys who can do this because we put the time in and we have a unique feat. And that's an interesting take on it. Anyway, to the next movement, which I love what he goes straight into, is pressing, basically a planche tuck press to handstand. And it's just like, it's just one of the things I said to Mikael at the start, just when we were having a bit of chat before we got started on this. There's no mention of sets and reps and hold times and other stuff in this book. It's just,
no, not a single one.
Just do. It's just like, do it and do this. And then it's just like, you know, he's doing it straight.
He basically says, each time try to press up a little higher until you can straighten all the way up into a handstand.
Yeah.
Don't allow the elbows to bend if you can possibly avoid it. So, yeah, it's definitely like, I mean, there of course, we're not just saying that you all like sets and reps are bad, but yeah, it's very interesting to just see that like the approach here as well among among these professionals were, yeah, very different.
Yeah, and it is just like, it is kind of interesting. I know a bit from the, shit, what is their name? There was the Saxon Trio. Their training, so some of the strongest men who ever lived, or definitely some of the strongest fucking machines, in they were around this kind of era, and their training would just be to go in and just lift heavy shit, the heaviest shit they could lift every single day, and just do their feats for thing, and just that was it. And then they just do that for 3 hours, and then they go eat like 10 pounds of meat each, drink beer, and then perform till 2 in the morning. So it was just kind of a different era. Not saying it's the best way. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for the way we train, but it does just give an insight. And it is like a lot way a lot of circus people train as well nowadays still. Like it's gotten a bit more refined, but there is just that era of just like, yeah, just go in and just do your stuff till you can do it. And then yeah. I think that is
Yeah, well, like the interesting thing, I mean, like, because there's so much in this book, so we can't maybe go through each thing
yeah.
they show, but they demonstrate and show you, like, in kind of the first chapter, you have stuff such as the press up to handstand, which basically would happen, that is demonstrated from doing it from a crow. Then it's like walking on the hands forwards, backwards, sideways, and in a circle, demonstrated straddle press up, where, like, from what it looks like, that it's the goal is to do a rather clean straddle press with arms straight and legs
Yeah,
straight, though
but this is
probably
to,
more.
yeah, it's like he says, like, master the tuck press first. Once you master number two, this is number five in his exercise. Try this one. Straighten the legs, increases the leverage, but spreads them, eases a bit. It is still harder than number two, but easier than number 17, which is weird because like he's basically doing a tuck plan, you know, a tuck press, which tuck planche press, which most of us would consider harder. But for him, obviously the straddle was the harder one. Yeah. I like the way there's just
And then, like,
like a one paragraph description for these things, whereas we have like a 45
yeah.
page book written
Huh.
for the one
I
thing.
know. Yeah, they have like what they call the hand balance press up from the chin, like AKA handstand push up. So it's basically you can start a trick by lowering a little by bending the elbows and press up again. Each time, try to lower a bit further, and you can go all the way down and back up again. I mean, it is true. It's very sensible. And like one thing that's really cool, because like the form of these, like, you have the, like, on three of the pictures is with extremely, like, a very bent back, as you would see. Some people still do handstand push-ups, but then you have one of Paulinetti doing one outside here, and it is absolutely super fucking straight, and it looks like kind of like one of those, like as if he's
Yeah.
on the way down into a 90-degree push-up, but like that looks like it is like super duper straight. So it has nothing to do with the ability or the lack of ability of doing it. That is
Yeah.
very clear.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing of the lead into next is like lower down to handstand, from a handstand to the stomach. They're basically just doing like the starting exercise for a 90-degree press up, the eccentric for it. Then after you've accomplished the lowering down from a handstand to the stomach, you may then practice to press up again. Yeah.
Easy peasy.
It's kind of interesting to take on the technique as well, because they say to keep the arms as straight as possible, as long as possible, and then bend them at
I
the last
guess
moment.
that's true.
Whereas
That's true.
I'd kind of coach this more like handstand push up, and then your head makes a J shape basically. It goes straight down, it goes straight down, and goes kind of down at an angle, and then goes out forward. Where they're like, I'm gonna planche down, planche, 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 and then press back up. And
And it does
if,
seem like he's using, since he's using the keeping the heels high by arching a bit,
yeah.
maybe that also makes it to make sense that you get to a much lower angle with your upper body while the legs are high,
Yeah.
and then you initiate the bend at that point rather than kind of keeping that straight form on the way down.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of, I do think I recall Coach Summer differentiating this type of press. Sorry, dying here. This type of press from a normal press. Hold on, let me die for a second.
Diet, please.
Yeah, if I remember right, he differentiates this one from a normal one, but I can't remember exactly. And then,
Yeah, I mean, like, go on.
I was going to say until the next move, which was forward roll up to handstand. But make your point.
Oh, no. No, I just wanted to,
yeah,
basically move on to the, like, because, like, they continue with, like, a bunch of moves, such as, like, the forward roll to handstand, essentially kind of a 90 degree push-up where you kind of do, like, a snake roll into it.
Yeah.
They do, like, back roll to handstand, and then, like, scissor handstand, as they call it. Do a handstand in nice form, then separate the legs, one backward and the other forwards.
Yeah, passing each other in scissor fashion. But
yeah,
the interest is to put a bit of this in context. If you find any of the old cinna rolls of these kind of acts, like a lot of these acts, the very first kind of stuff they do would be kind of more dynamic handstands. They'd come out, forward roll in the handstand, backward roll in the handstand, scissors, jump across the stage. It'd be kind of very like high energy, pizzazz. Whereas like now, you know, the style would be a bit more contemporary. I'll faff around on the floor for a bit. Like there was just a kind of element of these kind of shows, just like go out and wow the people immediately, because if not, they're going to be throwing stuff on your stage. This is one of the things we don't have nowadays, is like people don't bring stuff specifically to throw bad performances, whereas back in the day they did, and if you did not impress them very quickly, shit was getting fucked at you.
Yeah, it's definitely a different era in that sense. But there is one cool one here, like which they describe, which is the straight handstand with the head in between the arms, and then he shows a fully straight handstand, i.e. the chin on chest handstand, like looking at toes handstand, and it's perfect. Like there's nothing wrong with that handstand at all from a modern perspective. Like it's very clear that like this position is not like one that is hard for him, obviously. I mean, he's a master on his hands, but it's cool to just see like the different stuff they have here, because like there's just a bunch of different elements that they describe that you can kind of do. If you can do this, then you can learn that. If you can do that, then you can do that, like learn that. And like then there's like all these kind of stuff with like handstands on the fingers, like finger stands. People doing like two finger handstands. There is even like the thumb handstand, which the other writer of the book, Bob Jones, he was like famous for doing the thumb handstand, where he would like, we're gonna get to that later when the pictures come, but like he would stand on these like these clubs, and then he would remove four of them until he was standing on the two last clubs were nailed to the floor, he says. But like he would be like doing a thumb handstand on them, which is pretty damn badass.
So
it's
that kind of stuff. Like he has this kind of thing. He has the kind of full repertoire of two arm stuff. It's like, oh, I've got like, you know, half arm planche, what we'd call crocodile. We have like lying kind of things that would resemble what we'd consider like yoga pose, more in the yoga thing of like lying on, I think it's called dragonfly pose in yoga or stuff like that, where it's like, oh, lying and putting your arms out, your legs out to the side in a bent arm position. These kind of things are just there. And and then lowering down from handstand to the half planche or to the crocodile. And then this is one of the things that this book got me thinking, because now we're onto handstand on pointed fingers, fingertip handstands and two finger handstands and thumb handstands. And they have a lot of finger strength conditioning. And it's one of the things is just like, I've definitely dabbled with it, I've trained it, but I never really considered maybe it's a missing piece of the puzzle in handstands. Like obviously we rely on the specific training that we do to train our fingers, but maybe there's some merit to like doing specific finger strengthening exercises.
You made that point when we talked the other day. Yeah. And like, yeah, definitely. Like, I think modern hand balancing technique, we're aiming to not be so finger heavy in most of the balancing. But it's very interesting because like a lot of the things they advocate here is more kind of finger heaviness. And like there is a chapter that we're coming to that's called the hand balancing hands. And then you see some flexed forearms and stuff and talking about that, which is pretty cool. But like, and it's so interesting to see in this book, like all of the elements, like even stuff that's kind of obscure, really, such as like what we nowadays call a tiger bend, which is like elbow stand, and then you lean forwards quickly to your hands and then push up. Like that, they call that handstand, lower to elbow stand, and press up to the handstand. So like, Like, and then there's jumping on the hands. Like, they'd even describe stuff in this book, such as like jumping on one arm. They even describe like a move that people do in breakdancing, which is super hard, where you go from a one elbow stand, you kick and you go up to the hand, and you go back to the elbow and up to the hand. It's described in this book. And like Paulinetti was active in like the poster that we just described is from 1897, if I don't remember wrong. So he was active in like way back then, and meaning that like during these periods, so much of the stuff that like we kind of take for granted is kind of newer. It's like a lot of stuff has been around and just for so long. So it's just super, super cool to see. And then like all these grainy old black and white photos of these guys in just like underwear with little shoes on.
Yeah.
Doing all the stuff. It's super cool.
Yeah. It's definitely, that's the kind of thing of just like, there's only a limited way of moving the body. There is limitations imposed by our body. And this thing, then there's only certain things that look interesting or wow factor to people. And people have been wowed by the same shit for hundreds of years. It's just given a different sort of outer facing and dressing depending on what sort of is in vogue in society. But, you know, I found like, you know, my research going back thousands of years, I found history of contortion. I found people doing all the contortion feats, or most of them, that we'd consider contortion, you know, thousands of years ago. Yet people were still getting entertained by them back when they're building pyramids. Yeah. It's like, your day over building the pyramid is done. Would you like to sit down with a refreshment and watch this person bend themselves in half? Yes, I would. Mm. So the Pharaoh has been cheap and granted me a show. Or some shit like that. Anyway.
And like I thought too, like if we're just like moving down through these, like because like there's a whole lot, there's so many like elements through here, and I'm not gonna go through every single one, but like it of course comes to the one hand, the balance, and it's really cool to see, because like they also do that obviously in the arched back form, but like they. And here they talk about that thing of the fingers. They say, like, try to assume as much weight as on the palm as possible. This will allow you to use the fingers to better for a better advantage for the purpose of balancing. And and then he says, the best way to practice this trick is to do a handstand with one hand on the floor and the other on a raised object about a foot higher than the floor. Take as much weight as you can on the hand that's on the floor and hold as long as you can to acquire endurance. And this way you can reduce the weight on the hand, which is on top of the object, until you just touch with the tips of the fingers. And I mean, this is an exercise. I mean, just like kind of like the like grabbing the bar support. Like nowadays we use like the fingertip on the floor thing a lot, but like, but it's like this, what he describes here is a used method that people use nowadays.
Yeah.
And then he says, do not practice by doing a handstand on the floor and try to do the one hand balance immediately. This is a waste of time and energy. And of course, you must have mastered the two hand balance thoroughly before you commence on the one hand. It's of great benefit to practice this on each hand, as it will greatly strengthen you for all two handed tricks. And accomplishing this balance in even fair form elevates the performer above the amateur class.
Yeah. It's definitely like there's a lot in those few sentences there. And like, it's interesting, just like people were making the same fucking mistakes when he wrote this book and when he was training people and other stuff as people are doing nowadays. You haven't learned in the last like 130 years of like, do not just shift over and take your hand off and hope and pray. You're just wasting your time. And like, they were doing it back then and no one's learned and people still do it. And I think that's kind of interesting. And it's also like this book is kind of laid out in a way that you're kind of meant to work through all the exercises, and it is the gist I get from it, and work on them and kind of master them as you add to your kind of repertoire. So he'd be saying like all the things coming beforehand, handstand pushups, presses, head in handstand, lower to croc, all of these kind of things, which are, you know, yes, we have other stuff nowadays, but it's a lot of stuff we'd still be working on nowadays. Before, if like someone came into me and couldn't kick up to a handstand, we're not going to work on one arm. If someone can't really press to one handstand, I'll be like, well, maybe we should work on press, you know, these kind of things, like these are the things that go like, oh yeah, this is mastering the two arm. Now you can do the one arm once you kind of mastered these things. I think it's, you know, it is, you know, and it is one of those things like even this balance in even fair form elevates the performer above the amateur class. I think that's a good thing to say for anyone who's achieved the one arm, who got like a 5 or 10 second straddle hold, you know.
Yeah.
It is like, solid. It is an achievement. And like, you know, we are saturated in today and age when like everyone does the one arm and you have that appearance and all this. But it is something that just like, it is an achievement. And even back then, well, obviously back then, because like the only man alive who can do the shit. But it was just kind of like, you know, accepted. You're different if you've achieved the one arm. I'm not saying that you're special, you're just different.
Yeah. And it's cool. He says here too, once mastered, the one hand balance can be dressed up in many ways. Yeah. Juggling, playing a musical instrument, revolving on the one hand, picking up a weight, supporting a person.
Deporting, supporting a person.
Yeah,
I mean, you get out of my country.
And that is literally, I mean, that is literally like the move that I've done that many times, like having someone sit on your back when you one arm, like it's a classic circus trick. And yeah, they were doing that back then. I mean, they were doing sticker stuff, supporting people back then, as they, and some people are doing now too. But it's just cool. Like it's all there. Like people have been very creative with this stuff.
Yeah.
Like a very long time ago. Like, and I think it's one funny, like this thought I had when I see these pictures and look at it, like, and I think this might be a notion that is like a bit automatic.
Yeah.
Especially when you look at old pictures and the pictures themselves look so grainy and black and white, and you kind of assume that things were just maybe not as advanced back then in a lot of ways. But then again, like, it's just like their camera wasn't that advanced, but like the flesh and blood of these people, their creativity wasn't any less than ours in a lot of ways. The styles were different and culture was different, but like still there's like, of course, like someone being inside of this performance culture and like genetics and all that, they would want to try out new things. And I mean, then you have, of course, the planche described here.
Hold on,
like,
just 2 seconds. A note on the photos, actually, because somewhere else in the book, he talks about his rationale for the photos, and the style of photo he took was a slower print on the negative to prove that he was holding everything statically. It was one of the things that just to show that it wasn't just like wobbling in the movement, that it was held statically long enough to take the shot. Because nowadays we're used to like photo takes a second. Back in the day of the old school cameras where you had to like light some gunpowder to do the flash, it took a few seconds to get the imprint on the negative. So there is just, I can't remember, it's later on the book he says that. He's like, oh, I chose this style of photo over the newer style so people would know that I'm not just kick and praying it and taking a snapshot. I'm actually holding it.
Yeah, and like the, what was I supposed to say? Apparently, like there, he used to have a lot of pictures of all his performances through the years, but apparently his family passed away in a tragic fire, and all of the photos of him was also lost. Like he survived the fire, he wasn't there or something. But like there aren't that many, or there isn't that much documentation of his other stuff, that at least he had, other than what was published in this book due to that. Yeah, like, and then they show, I mean, like, they show one arm jumping here. They show, this is one I think is kind of cool. They show the revolving half arm planche, like, i.e., turning crocodile.
Yeah.
And they have a little, like, a description here for how you make a turning element, which does seem to not use, like, ball bearings, because I guess that wasn't just as easy to come across as nowadays. But there is some sort of, like, gizmo here that they describe on how to create a turning element. So I mean, like, and this is also something that you'd think be like, oh yeah, that must be kind of like a little bit of an advanced engineering thing to make work. But like, hey, yeah, this is like 100 years ago plus, and people were already thinking that, oh yeah, like, okay, I can do a one arm, like, how can I make it turn? And then like,
I bet you the audience still applauded for that one. Does a one arm handstand? Yeah. No one cares. Does a one arm juggling? No one cares. Does a half arm planche and revolves? Audience goes wild.
He even says it here. This is always a very effective trick when performed in a proper technical style.
Yeah.
So the turning croco was popular back then. It still turns heads today, and it sucks. It's awesome.
It's just like, it's the money trick. I remember, like, I described it as that to like a few people. It's like, I think some guys were working on making their first act. I was like, you have to put it in. Why? We've just been doing one arms. It's like, you don't understand. It's the money trick. They went and performed their first show with this new act. They'd done it, and they said the only time people applauded was at the end and at the money trick. So you're going to have your money trick. And then,
of course, like the big one, the one-hand balance planche. And he says, without doubt, this is the greatest acrobatic or gymnastic feat that has ever been accomplished without artificial aid. The author is the only one who has ever mastered this extraordinary stunt and performed it for a number of years. And I mean, nowadays, there's been more people that have done that do one-arm planche, but like he does it pretty damn well. On like, apparently, like there's a story around the picture of him being in the one-arm planche here too, where like the one taking the photo of it, he was so flabbergasted when he saw him lower into the one-arm planche that he pushed a button too slow, so Paulinetti had to do it several times in a row. Therefore, the form was not as good as in his normal one. Though, I mean, the form on this picture is pretty damn good, and I'm like, from his descriptions, I really believe that he could do it even straighter than it is here. But this is something that's also to be said about like a big part of this book. A lot of it is like a large kind of, because like a lot of it is written by Bob Jones, this 1945 version of the book is written by Bob Jones, a student of Paulinetti, and very much of it is kind of like glorifying Paulinetti as the greatest who's ever lived. Of course, I am. I think that is completely fine, but it's quite evident that like there's kind of a lot of boasting around him being incredible, and I'm sure he was that incredible. But it's very kind of I guess a love letter in that sense to his.
You gotta blow a bit of smoke up your master's ass every now and then. That's fine.
Exactly.
I expect that from all my students from occasionally. They never do it, but I expect it, and you know, one day they will. When I'm dead, he'd be like, the greatest coach that's ever lived, taught me everything. Anyway, then one of the things I find kind of interesting on this as well is, now that we've finished the chapter, so you've got to the one-arm planche, you've now mastered hand balancing, they have some routines for you to put together, exhibition routines. And it's kind of interesting, it's just got like the list of exercises to do in a row, like hand balance exercise, walking on hands, forward, backwards roll, straddle roll, blah blah blah, straddle press, half handstand with head, straight handstand with head between the arms, half arm plank. All of these would be kind of almost in the form of a gymnastic routine, like a compulsory routine. And then it has the advanced single exhibition routine. After having mastered this routine, you will be able to compete with any of the professional hand balancers. So press the handstand, forward drop, jerks and swing tempo, jackknife handstand, other stuff. You know, one arm planche, and then the alligator walk to finish. It's just like, you have to keep with any professional hand balancer. Like, by the way, here's the last thing they say on the one arm is like, one arm planche, the only person to ever achieve this feat. So if you can do this routine, you're up there with the best of them. It's like,
It's quite obvious. This one is kind of like a bit of a, it's kind of like a bit of an elbow to probably the community of the people in that era. Or just like, oh, well, this is the advanced one. You just need to do the hardest hand balance feat ever done in your routine at the end. Then you're advanced.
Yeah.
Like it's a bit like that. And that's also, I think it's a bit in the thread with a lot of the stuff they say through the book, that like they like the different artists, they would kind of be a bit secretive about their different moves and kind of like size each other up a bit. And it would have kind of maybe a competitiveness then that like you would rather nowadays find in sports, since like the way to be special was to be able to do the XYZ in a lot of ways.
I think it's one of the interesting things as well, like, because they wouldn't show their primo feat on their lithograph. That would be kept secret. People just talk about it and spread. There's a guy who does a handstand on an alligator balancing a ball or some shit like this. But if they knew, a lot of time, if they knew there was another circus family or another performer in the audience, they wouldn't do their hardest feat. They didn't want them to see it to be able to copy it.
Mm.
That's kind of an interesting one. So onto chapter two. So we've now mastered hand balance, and we're just going to meet who our teacher was. So he's just, you know, he's been speaking in your ear for the last while. And I'm going to read the story out because it's fun. Early in November 1920, the word was passed about in the city of Calcutta, India, that an event of interest would happen at noon of a certain day atop the dome of the Empire Theatre building. Interesting. What could this be? Their curiosity aroused and spurred on by the fact that they would see something for free of charge, the natives thronged about the square where stood the popular playhouse. Promptly, at midday, a figure appeared as if from nowhere, arising from behind the ball atop the dome of the building. Seemingly, he grasped the smooth side of the spear, leaning forward, and placed his head on top of it, slowly pressed up into the perfect balance on the head, the hands being held by the hips and the legs spread apart and inclined forward. There, clad in blue tights that made him visible from a considerable distance, the performer reigned for at least 30 seconds. To the watchers below, it seemed an hour. Then, just as slowly as rose the balance, he lowered his body and disappeared from view behind the home by way of the same ladder which he had ascended. While on the packed street below the street, the crowd roared their approval. They had met Paolinetti and they liked him.
It's glorious. It's absolutely great. And like, I also actually wrong here. It says that he's born in this country of French, English, and Irish ancestry. I thought he was telling that. That was my bad. But it's interesting here because it says that like he started as a professional tumbler in 1873 at the age of 10 and rapidly developed into a high-class worker on all apparatus in tumbling and dancing. And then he broke his left kneecap in 1899 when he alighting from an horizontal bar, and it laid him up for 7 months. And although there has since been no stiffness in the member, i.e. his leg, he decided it best
no
to give up
as
the
member.
Sorry. He's really great.
It's my last blaze of glory.
Sorry. I had to do it.
Good one. Yeah, good move. But yeah, basically he hurt his knee and decided then to take up hand balancing. It's kind of cool. They do describe kind of his, like, here's where they describe some of his strength feats and stuff.
Just one thing just to note here. In instance, at a weight of 109 pounds, he had a 14.25-inch upper arm. That's pretty fucking big arms for someone who weighs 50 kilos.
Yeah.
Like,
and he had like, and he says that like, he had, in addition to performing the usual tricks requiring tremendous pulling strength, he could also do the feats regarding great pushing strength. At the above-mentioned body weight, 109 pounds, he could press with either hand 125 pounds, employing only a limited amount of side bend. So I assume then he means one of those, like, one-arm, like the kind of, like, side-bendy old-school lift?
Yeah, like a side press or bent press. But only a small amount of side bend just means he's doing it, like, basically with shoulder power. But it's just kind of interesting, like, this, you know, that's basically 1.25 body weight. It's pressed in one arm.
Yeah, that is like, absolutely insane.
You know, you'd be hard pressed nowadays to find a lot of people who could do that.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the strength to weight ratio is in his favor, but still.
Yeah, and it says here, and this I've wondered, like, also at the same weight, he did the correct military press of 85 pounds, which still stands as a record. But do they refer to a military press?
The military press back then is the barbell press from the shoulders overhead. But the military press, you would stand to attention like a man of the military with your feet together. So you wouldn't be doing legs apart. There'd be no drive, strict, and press it overhead. So 85 pounds, like, you know, over 3/4 body weight is pretty good. But it is just kind of interesting, just, you know, the discrepancy from one arm to the other.
Yeah.
But still pretty good.
And I mean, he was a pretty small man. It says here also, like, with such strength, he can readily, with such strength, it can be readily understood how he could push up into the one-arm handstand from the half-arm planche or from almost any other position he cared to use. And when they say push up into the one-arm handstand from the half-arm planche, then we're talking about a crocodile press to a one-arm handstand.
Yeah.
And this is in the, like, in 1900, he could do these things. Like it's very hard to find anyone that can do that nowadays, even. So, and it's very cool because I remember, or I assumed he could, but it's cool. Later on in the book, he describes how he does it, and it's super cool because, like, the way he describes it, we'll find the text for that later. But he literally describes, like, the curling of the spine sideways as he would bend his legs around, like the exact way which like the only way it's possible to properly do it. And that I think find like super fascinating. Like, it's not like I completely believe he could do that, because like if you didn't know how that works, because it's such a extremely niche movement, you couldn't be able to describe it like that.
Exactly. So one point here that I want to point out, during his professional career, which lasted some 50 years. So this guy was performing from age 15 to 65 or something. You know, it is one of those things, like we say, hand balancers generally have quite a long career in circus if they want. And it's generally true, like this kind of thing, that it's not as obliterating on your body as aerial or tumbling or other stuff can be. And it is, you know, yeah, it is just pretty cool. Like it is just like, oh, he's performing up to his 60s, basically. So there's a lot of hope for you out there if you're like, if you're coming into hand balance going, I'm 45, I'm doing handstands, I'm not going to make it. You've probably got about 20 years of practice ahead of you before you can start thinking that you're not going to make it.
Brilliant.
You know, there's plenty of time.
It says here that his first foreign tour was in 1892, and his last terminated early 1923 when he retired.
And that
And
was, he was
what was
performing in the States beforehand as well, in 70, like from the 70s. So he's performing 20 years in the States before he took his foreign tour.
And like it's cool, like further down in the book here too, like there are pictures of him at his, what is it, his 65th birthday, where he does a full planche. He does a one arm handstand. He does a full headstand with his legs together and arms by his hip, and some sort of like one arm press up. So like I especially this, like a full planche at 65 years old is just, it's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's just, yeah, it's cool. Like, you know, part of me is thinking, like, what would happen if we gave Palmetti the sauce? What would have happened?
We need to resurrect him and give him the sauce.
Yeah. Do, where we go? Where's the Italian story?
But Emmett, I actually think we need to do two episodes on this, because like we're up at an hour now and we've barely made it into the book.
Yeah, I think we can do like another couple of chapters. We'll do about an hour and a
Totally.
half. This is good, and then we'll could do a
Go
second
for
one, part two. This because the story about the Italian. Where are we going? Sorry, scrolling down. This is fun. So, yeah, do. We're made in the photos of some of the photos were made in Milan, Italy, some 25 years ago. An interesting story connected to the event. The photographer who made them was a very good acrobat himself. He did the one-arm chin several times with either hand, did considerable apparatus work, and was a good hand balancer. Of course, he was greatly interested in the feats being performed before his camera. Things progressed very well. He made several exposures of several head balance, one-arm handstand, and the point arrived at the one-arm planche to be snapped. Now, the gentleman had not previously seen Paolinelli perform, and when our friend did a one-arm handstand drop slowly into a perfect planche, body perfectly horizontal, and arm straight, the photographer was so amazed at the feat that he forgot his camera. He just stood open-eyed, open-mouthed, beholding the spectacle. Paolinetti held the position several p seconds, then lowered his feet, and not until he stood erect did the photographer snap out of it. He apologized for his failure to make the exposure and promised to do the job correctly again. After a moment's rest, Paolinetti again went into the balance and held the position while the exposure made. But then the f do -do -do, But when the photographer reached to remove the plate holder from the camera, behold, so greatly was he excited by this unusual feat, he'd forgotten to put the plate holder in the camera. So, this is it. Back then, people were getting their minds blown by the shit. Or, so the person doing the shit says. It's like, yes, definitely not my thing. Definitely kind of really interesting. Just,
Yeah, and it's like this is what's also what's cool about, like, there's something I think is really cool here too in relation to like the period, because like it says here when when he had when he was in Berlin, like, because they mentioned Paul Cincavalli here.
Cincavalli,
he
yeah.
was yeah he's this like super legendary juggler as well from the same era. So it's like, I remember hearing about Cincavalli a lot when I was in circus school. Like, the jugglers there, they would talk about him as like, you had like Rastelli, or that's another
Rastelli,
one of
yeah.
those. Yeah, exactly. And then, but then that, like, this Cincavalli guy was like almost even more obscure than him in one way, or like they knew that he was incredible and existed, but that there was like less resources on him, or stuff like that. But yeah, and this is one of the reasons why I would certainly recommend anyone to read this book, is because it has such like its teaching ability, like what you can learn hand balance is very limited, but there's like the historically, and like it's so rich in terms of all these like tiny stories they tell here, like some of them we're reading out to you now and kind of talking about, but there's just like so much of that stuff that like it's of course impossible for us to go through everything. So
yeah,
it's a very
I wouldn't want to read the thing anyway. I want you to get it and read it. And Logan and Chris are like, how the fuck am I making so much cash off this shit at this moment? Anyway, you can say thank you and send us a signed copy.
I just want to say this one, because here's the one you talked about with the planche things on the rings. Because like it's a description of when just the other day, however, he told me of one occasion where he was stuck with a rival performer. There was this a Spanish ring worker whose specialty was doing the crucifix, one arm roll up, one arm chins, etc. In fact, all work requiring tremendous strength of the biceps and latissimus muscles. This chap weighed but 102 pounds, yet had an upper arm some 15 inches around.
That's pretty fucking big arms.
Yeah, and almost entirely bicep at that. Well, Polinetti met him one day in the gymnasium, and of course they began matching their skill. The Spaniard did their one arm roll up, the hand balance on the rings, the crucifix, etc., all of which Polinetti easily duplicated. In turn, he stumped the Spaniard by doing a back planche hanging below the rings. Then, while keeping the body horizontal throughout, he pulled through the planche at the hips and pushed into the planche with straight arms above the rings, then went into the handstand. The Spaniard could go as far as the planche at the hips, but did not have the tricep and shoulder development necessary to push from there while keeping the body horizontal. But he would not admit defeat. No, sir. He still had an ace up his sleeve. Calling for a 56-pound weight, he held it in one arm and did the one-hand chin with the other. Imagine a 102-pound man chinning himself plus 56 pounds additional and with one hand. Polinetti told him to keep his blooming weight. He might need it for a watch charm. So yeah. there are more of these kind of stories of him kind of meeting with the others.
Yeah.
Testing out the skill and all that. It's super awesome. Yeah, they mentioned Lillian Lightsill here too. She was like a legendary trapeze artist.
Yeah. Hold on, missed it. Or forget that bit. Oh yeah, down past. Yeah. Would like to say that actually just past the bit we just read. There's some photos of Paolinetti doing one arm handstand, planche, headstand with legs together, and the slow push to one arm handstand. So like basically cartwheel up the handstand, one arm handstand, that kind of side press at 65. They prove the wonderful strength and balancing power he still possesses. No shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super awesome. I absolutely love it. And yeah, then like there is an entire chapter on kind of like the extraordinary gymnastic achievements. Yeah. Which of course then it's like this is a little bit like there's some different people kind of mentioned in that, but like very often in relation to Polinetti and how he would be a, like slightly more glorious than everyone. There is an interesting one here.
You know, here's just one comment I would say. He's just talking about his accident. My accident laid me up for 7 months. During that time, I did much thinking and trying to decide, Just which one of the arts I wish to take up, and finally decided to put myself through a highly specialized system of training, the art of hand and head balancing. You know, I know a lot of people who are very good on their hands and in circus, and the reason they got good in their hands is because they sprained their ankle or janked their knee or something else was going on. They said, you know what, I'm just going to do handstands. And you know, it's just, it's an interesting thing. It's just like, once again, this kind of universality. My leg is fucked, I'm still going to do something, going to do handstands, you know. It is just a thing, and yeah, it's just interesting.
And it's cool here. He also says that, like, during when he was learning it, that, like, he was he had trained a lot and it didn't work to do the one arm, and like 2 months of the most strenuous practice found me with little or no progress, and I was on the verge of giving up and acknowledging defeat. But the thought came to me, what will all those people whom I made my boast think of me? This made me dismiss all thoughts of defeat, and I went on to practice with renewed vigor. Yeah. One morning, the thought came to me, how do I balance on my feet? I stood on one foot, then on the other in different positions, and found that the natural position was the true position, with the toes pointed slightly outwards from the center and the leg perfectly rigid. I then wondered what the natural position of the hands would be without looking at them. I opened them out as they hung by my side and discovered that they were in the exact position as I stood on my feet, and the fingers were separated. I placed my hands on the floor in that position and pushed so hard my arms were rigid. I leaned over with my weight on the right hand, and my astonishment, I could feel a balance in this rigid position, and I was able to remain there for a few seconds.
You know,
I'd
like to say that, like, that I remained there for a few seconds on his first one arm is probably one of those ones, like, everyone knows that feeling when you learn in one arm. It's like, hand comes off the floor, I'm balancing, I'm doing it. You come down, you think you're up there for 5 seconds, and it was actually just a second. Time slows down, Paolo Netti, for all of us. There's one little line here I just want to point out as well. And recommended me to Professor Edward Muybridge for the purpose of posing for the professor's series of instantaneous photography, which he named, brackets or quotation marks, animal locomotion. Were people doing animal flow back in the 1890s? Was that a thing? Yeah. Probably. Animal locomotion. Yeah. People were still trying to move like animals back then. Once again, there's this kind of universality to the human fitness culture where people are just doing these kind of things, like mimicking animals. It was a thing. It's always been a thing. And now we're just doing a different thing, which is a bit weird. And we're like, oh, it's a bit cringy. Was it cringy back then? Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? But it's just interesting. Just, yeah, once again, you're just doing shit that's 150 years old thinking it's new. No, yeah. It's not.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, yeah, just getting the words from, it's a completely different generation from a world we have no, like, under, like, it's so hard to, like, imagine a life during that time, but still, how, like, yeah, they're just people just like us.
Yeah.
But
I like his comment on learning the planche and then the front lever as well. And his comment, this about the front lever, the same feet upside down while hanging from rings of bar is infinitely easier to hold. And this feat is accomplished by first trying to hold the position with the legs bent backwards from the knees as far as possible, thus shortening the leverage. Oh shit, they were doing tuck back planche and tuck planche back in the day, and that was how they trained it. And that's basically how we train it nowadays, with a few tweaks and modifications here and there. So it's just, you know, it is just interesting. It's just like body weight training. There's only certain ways to manipulate the parameters, and most people kind of figured them out. You know, I blame the Greeks, they invented leverage.
Yeah, it's all because of them, the bastards.
Yeah.
Right. It's it's a very fascinating read. And yeah, like, because, like, the book is rather long. There's, like, loads of chapters, and, like, I mean, up until this point, we haven't even come to, like, the other, right, like, the writer of the second edition there, like, Robert Jones, aka Bob Jones, who is known as the man who stands on his thumbs. So, like, there's loads of, like, descriptions of him and his life and kind of, like, how he learned, and there's a lot of this kind of like descriptions or like various like, yes, so then he went there and then he
Hold
went
on, there's a
there and
great
then
quote
like.
here actually about a this gentleman, Mr. Hugo Moulton, one of the finest horizontal bar performers. He did all of his feats on a single horizontal bar, and three of the feats he performed were considered impossible by all the leading gymnasts of Europe and America for a person to accomplish who possessed two lower limbs in normal proportion. There's kind of an interesting thing here that I need to point out in the social context is we would have had the Boer War, we would have had World War One at these times and other wars, and also just, let's face it, medicine wasn't advanced. I have a little segue into family story. So one of my family direct ancestors is a guy called Dr. Martin Scales, and he was a surgeon in the Boer War, and he was renowned in the British Army for being the fastest amputation specialist going. Because when you had a
Oh, dude.
soldier who, had to come in, you had to get a limb off. We're not going to fix a limb. We don't have surgery. We're just going to chop that shit off. You have to get it off as fast as possible because they don't have anesthetic. They don't have painkillers, maybe opium, whatever. You have to get it off and sealed. And he had the record for like getting limbs off in 30 seconds or some shit like that.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Just like, you've ever seen an old surgeon's kit as well? It's more in common with a butcher's like knife bag than what you'd consider like scalpels and fine tools. No, like they had knives like filleting knives and other stuff. Anyway, so in this kind of time of the vaudeville area and the sort of show hall era, there was a lot of performers who would have been missing limbs, and it would have been part of the novelty of their act, either using it to their advantage and performing feats that would be very difficult, or just as a kind of novelty. The one-legged man tap dancing, or one-armed man playing piano, or these kind of things, or these things like, obviously we have freak shows and other stuff that came a bit later, but it was a thing that people missing limbs was more common back then than it was now, and these people would still like go on to be performers and other stuff, just to pick up any career. So it was just kind of interesting. Obviously, we didn't have adaptations and other kind of, we probably would have had, but like they wouldn't have been as advanced as we have now. So it is just kind of interesting that it is mentioned here in a couple of points. We're just talking like, oh, we have high bar performers. Like I remember seeing an old showreel of a trapeze artist who was missing his legs and was just doing like constant in locations and other stuff through the bars and other kind of stuff. So it is just an interesting thing. It was just there, like just part of society at that time. Have a farm accident. Oh, we can't stitch that shit. It's got infected. Off it comes.
Yeah, it's definitely like a part of, or you see that like Polinetti also talks about that like the he had seen the one arm plunge done by like a man without that, like I'm not sure if he didn't have legs at all or if he had like if he was an amputee or however it was, but that like when he decided to learn the one arm plunge, it was after he had seen someone do it,
Yeah.
Jewel Keller, and then he had decided that like he and he would he had been told that it wouldn't be possible, and because of that, then that was kind of his one of his main motivators
Yeah.
for deciding to learn it. And of course, he had an insane physical frame for learning those kind of things. And
Yeah. I think one of the
it's.
other photos here, the caption is great. He's doing a arms up, legs together, or legs crossed daintily, I'll have to say. Heads free headstand on a little podium. And the caption is, "If you think this is easy, try it. A stunt that is very seldom, if ever, seen." And it's true. Like seeing, free headstand, straddle leg, it's not too difficult to move to learn. Legs up, it's a bit harder. Arms up is very fucking rare. Honestly,
Yeah,
yeah.
it's pretty rare to see
Even
people do that.
nowadays,
So
yeah.
yeah, it's definitely a rare one. And I mean, the cool thing is, like, I mean, then that I think is one very significant difference from that era to now is that like now even me, most people that train really hard stuff, we do it to do that in training, and then you perform something else. These guys like they trained it to perform it because you had to do the hard stuff on stage, or else
Yeah.
like you were kind of wasting your time. You'd rather do train something that you're going to put on stage. That is the moment of glory. It's the only place where people will really see you do it. Whereas nowadays, like we have internet, but
the internet. So I like to take picture people throwing cabbages at their phone when someone falls out of a trick. Back to show.
Yes. Or maybe that's what we need. We need like kind of a like emoji thing where you can like throw tomatoes at people. Like instead of a dislike button.
Yeah, there's one bit at the end of this chapter which I think is very cool. It's a letter Paolinetti received from Eugene Sandow. So Eugene Sandow is, you know, the first bodybuilder, I would credit. He's also a machine of a man. And, you know, the first, you know, the trophy that they give out at the, whatever the bodybuilding competition is called, where there are monsters nowadays, is called the Sandow in his honor. But it's called, "Dear Sir, I saw your show at the Alhambra and was astounded to see you do a number of feats I had never seen before. Bear in mind, Sandow was a performer, had been around the circuit. This was, you know, his thing, posing, exhibitions, acrobatics, the work. I also admire your neatness and finish. Yours truly, Sandow." That's just like, you know, it's like, your neatness and finish. It's like, not only were you doing it, you were doing it with a bit of pizzazz, a bit of style. And that's kind of, I don't know.
It's really cool. I mean, Eugene Sandow is a known name. In he's a big legend within bodybuilding. It's fun to see, like, all these other names, like, mentioned within there. And, like, a lot of names that will be obscure to people that haven't, like read the circus history, of course.
Yeah.
But, like, it's very, you can see this was like a smaller circle of people, and which makes sense. I mean, of course, there were many people worldwide performing, but the, at least like the ones that are in the States, such as this in the vaudeville kind of circuits, they knew of each other, obviously.
Yeah.
It seems like, I mean, like Paolinetti, like he says, he was touring a lot abroad in Europe and even Asia. I mean, like, he was in like doing the headstands in India.
Canada, yeah.
It's pretty epic.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think that's a good point to stop because we're going on to chapter 4, The Man Who Stands on His Thumbs, which is about Bob Jones.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we'll pick up next week or whenever we get around to recording. Try to record these in batch so we get them done quickly. But we're going to leave you there. I hope we've inspired you about Paolinetti. And other than that, we'll speak to you soon.
The Handstand Cast is brought to you by Handstand Factory and is produced by Motion Impulse. Thanks for tuning in. You can find a full transcript of each episode along with the show notes and any relevant references on handstandfactory.com/podcast. Thanks to Isaac for editing and Jordan for transcriptions. Music by Daniel Horwath. If you want to support the show, you can buy us a coffee on buymeacoffee.com or consider starting one of our Handstand Factory online programs. Links are in the show notes.